Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you doing?
All right, thank you. Well, except the summer has gone away again, and one of the few, only signs that it was ever here is an abundance of courgettes and broad beans in the bottom drawer of my fridge, where they're looking a bit sorry for themselves. Which reminds me that it's a while since we've had an allotment update from you.
I have to say this causes me great pain and jealousy because my broad beans are a total disaster. I do not have an abundance of broad beans or even courgettes. Everyone can grow courgettes. This is famous. Everyone knows this, that they're easy. But this year, even my courgettes haven't worked.
Well, Lucy, I can't claim to have grown courgettes.
Oh, I thought you meant ones you've grown.
Oh, hell no. A kind farmer up the road.
Very jealous.
I once grew broad beans and they got to be about, more than a metre high, which seemed quite tall to me.
Yeah.
And then I went away for 3 days and came back and they'd been completely decimated.
Black fly.
By snails.
Oh, really? Yeah. It's just, yeah. I've got high hopes, literally, for my sweet corn. Put it that way.
Okay, well, that comes later in the season, doesn't it? So, do you read books about growing things, or do you tend to wing it?
No, I'd sort of do both, really. I mean, I read lots and lots of books just about it because it's interesting, and also you want tips and things. And then I also make it up when I get there, and that's partly why I find it so fascinating, because it's so local in particular. And even if you know exactly what your soil is and what grows where and what you had the year before and what you're supposed to do, something will change in the local conditions. You know, so last year, there were basically hardly any slugs and snails. Everything thrived, yeah. But there was tons of black fly and white fly and stuff like that. And this year I went up and they basically put napkins round their necks and really, really gone for it this year. So I read books about it for information and for pleasure, but practically you've just got to sort of, you know, go there and look at what's worked and what hasn't, because the only constant I can think of is that not everything will work.
Yep. The mysteries of the allotment. Well, that concludes this week's gardening segment. Coming up on the rest of the show, the Uruguayan novelist Mario Livrero died in 2004, leaving behind him a final work of fiction entitled The Luminous Novel, a strange, ironic experiment in autofiction, which our reviewer Michael Kerrigan says lurches on its awkward, clumsy way with all the grace of a circus bear negotiating a tightrope. And yet, it grips the imagination in ways we cannot pin down or ignore. Michael Kerrigan will guide us through Livrero's improbably enthralling thicket of mundane incidentals and miscellaneous items from this week's TLS, including a dazzling history of Sicily, the demise of local journalism, and bald philosophy, whatever that is. But first, Lucy, over to you.
Do Yes, well, if you are familiar with the lovely hills of Camberwell, Wimbledon's green and empurpled hills, or the idea of angels in a tree on Peckham Rye, then you're either an extremely committed South Londoner or perhaps a fan of William Blake, the visionary who saw wonders everywhere and communicated them urgently in art and poetry. This week, we are looking at a book by John Higgs with the modest title William Blake Versus the World. Nick Groom, who's a professor of literature and English at the University of Macau, wrote about it for us, and we're delighted he's here to talk to us today. Nick, hello, and thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Lucy. How are you?
All right, thank you. And looking forward to, the first question I wanted to ask, which is a silly question, looking forward to finding out if the title is William Blake Versus the World, who won?
Well, I think that John Higgs' answer is that the jury is still out.
Oh, good.
This has been going on for over 250 years now. Finally, I think the world is beginning to catch up with William Blake. But there's still a lot of unresolved business.
Let's start with trying to talk about kind of what he was, because in your piece you say that a friend that Blake made later on in life said his creativity confounded simple categories. Can you kind of unpack that for us a little bit, please?
Yes, well, I think that William Blake clearly impressed many people he met at a very profound level. And this is partly because, and I think this is an important thing to say from the outset, from the very beginning, is that he lived in a different world. And he offers us glimpses of that. He was he was fantastic with words. He was amazing with his artwork. And so we get glimpses of this alternative, of this Blakean vision. And that certainly impressed his contemporaries. It's continued to impress people to this day. And I think one of the important things is that we are gradually, I think, as literary critics, as art critics, coming to terms with the fact that many people see the world differently. There isn't some universal human perception of the world. And Blake is an extreme example of this. Somebody who sees, experiences, and then communicates the world in a completely unique and individual and idiosyncratic way. And that's what I think really impressed and captivated both his contemporaries and, as I say, readers and people who've looked at his art and studied it ever since.
But it also, didn't it? Because some people, I think, probably thought that he was delusional or, you know, a madman. And there's the other side of it. Do you think it's a problem, this category confusion, in terms of how he's been perceived?
Yes, it is. And I think certainly it is in his time. He tended to be dismissed as being mad, being an unfortunate lunatic, as he was once described. Public reviews of his work tended to be generally dismissive. And there's a sort of sense that Blake's uniqueness was something that was so beyond the beaten track, so out of the experience of his contemporaries, that it did seem to be quite alien. And yet the notion of artistic genius stroke madness is something that's been around for centuries. Everyone knows the lines from Shakespeare, the poet, the lover, and the lunatic were of a likeness all compact. So there's that sort of sense of creativity, imaginative vibrancy, and vision can veer very close to the delusional, to the deluded, or to the mad.
And how long after his death then did people start to engage with his work seriously, you know, to take it, as you said, at face value? And what did they find first? Who started the reappraisal?
Well, he certainly did have his enthusiasts. People like Henry Crabb Robinson, the diarist. He befriended Blake about a year and a half before Blake's death, and he was clearly entranced by him. And so there was a core of early Blake enthusiasts. But then at the same time, you have this, you know, voluminous body of material from the early poems and sketches through to the great illuminated books of his later years. For example, his early biographer, Alexander Gilchrist, was absolutely flummoxed when it came to the later work and sort of famously tried to grapple with them and was, you know, simply incapable of actually making sense of it.
And it struck me that one of the amazing things about him wasn't that he was just a fantastic dreamer, was he? He was also a radical, firmly embedded in the realities of the world he saw around him, which was often filled with poverty and deprivation. I had a look at a couple of the chimney sweeper poems are completely straightforward and completely sort of heartbreaking, you know, about the children being sent up the chimneys. He was a radical realist as well, wasn't he?
He was. He was unflinching in his portrayal of late 18th century poverty and of London life, particularly in the plight that children found themselves. He himself lived in unbelievably humble circumstances. To mention Crabb Robinson again, he described Blake's poverty as living in squalid filth. You know, people read the Songs of Innocence and they are deceptively simple and straightforward, but actually they are very heartbreaking tales and vignettes of the social conditions of the time. The poem London, for example, yeah, absolutely. It's an incredibly powerful attack on, you know, child prostitution, sexually transmitted in infections, the sort of social hypocrisy of the period. So that stuff is there in Blake from the very outset, and it really becomes one of the cornerstones of his own mythology, this myth-making that he engages in.
It's like Oliver Twist or something, except he does it in about 12 lines. Dickens takes a bit longer.
it is like Oliver Twist. I mean, I love Dickens, but what one doesn't... I mean, Dickens has a threads of humour, and I don't think that you really get that with Blake. Blake was angry, or rather passionate, perhaps would be a better term. I mean, he does seem to have been a man who was driven and indeed overwhelmed by these emotions, by this sort of sense of injustice, and an attempt to try to reimagine the world and offer it as an alternative.
This same radicalism, which included also writing about the fall of kings and organised religion, right at the height of the French Revolution when Europe was in a panic anyway, that could be dangerous to him, couldn't it, the radicalism?
Oh, it could be extremely dangerous. And of course, he got into a bit of an issue with a soldier, was charged with sedition, and that could have had very, very serious consequences. But, you know, Blake is somebody who... You know, he does have this sense of what is right, and he's not going to stand by and be bullied by the authorities or by authoritarian figures.
And that's true on a smaller scale as well, isn't it? He had a general dislike of authority, didn't he? He sort of fell out with lots of people, I think, but in particular there was a falling out with the Royal Academy, and then he fell out with his patron too. So, I mean, both of these things must have had pretty disastrous consequences for his career prospects, you would think, at least in the short term.
Yes, I mean, he was clearly somebody who didn't suffer fools gladly. And his definition of a fool was very much William Blake's definition of a fool. So he had very high and personal principles. And of course, that's one of the things that has attracted generations of free thinkers, radicals, and even libertarians to him. And so he has become the touchstone of an alternative and radical English artistic tradition.
If we're turning to the book, John Higgs, you say he gives us vertiginously ahistorical perspectives. Can you talk us through some of these?
Yes, well, this is one of the things that I was in two minds about when I actually read the book, because there has been a growing tendency over the past few years to use our modern theories of mind to analyse art and poetry. And there have been some very good examples of this, such as Roderick Tweed's work specifically on Blake. John Higgs, I think, takes this a step further. He's certainly inspired by Tweedy. But he talks about the entropic brain, the default mode network of, that's a sort of neuroscientific way of mapping the brain, hemispheric lateralization. Because of the whole panoply of neuroscientific models that John Higgs is using to try to get inside Blake's thinking, and more importantly, his imagination and the way that he saw things. This sense that he did literally see them, and how is that possible? How is it possible for the brain to produce, to make these images with such hyperreal clarity? And so the more I read this, I mean, although the fact that it's, you know, is way beyond people in the humanities to be thinking about neuroscience and also theoretical physics. He goes on to talk about sort of quantum theory. Nevertheless, I think in this book it works as a way of beginning to bring Blake into sharper focus, suggesting that, you know, at the boundaries of neuroscience, there are theories and sort of indeed experiments which seem to open up ways of thinking about the mind and the self and consciousness and always the imagination that Blake has already expressed. And so in the end, I actually sort of found it, if not persuasive, incredibly tantalizing and suggestive. And certainly it made me think about Blake in a very fresh way. And I'd certainly like to be able to share that with the readers.
Because that's what I was wondering. I was wondering if it was convincing. Does it help to think about, I mean, it sounds as though it does, but I mean, I'm being a bit flippant, but he mentions Blake and Einstein and Paul McCartney and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Presumably not all of that lands, does it? Or maybe it does.
No, I think the Einstein stuff lands. I mean, what little I know about Einstein, he certainly persuaded me of that. I think that the popular cultural references to the Beatles, to Bowie, to Star Wars, I don't think they really work, not least because Blake himself is somebody who is reluctant to have those very culture-specific references in his work. He's always mythologizing them. But I think that the bigger ideas really do work. I think previously I'd been reluctant to use 21st century medical and neuroscientific thinking as a way of approaching writers and artists of the past. I prefer to actually look at theories of the mind from the late 18th and early 19th centuries and see how Blake might have fitted into that sort of early ways of thinking about consciousness, or into the sort of radical theology that he flirted with. But I think that Higgs is it's intriguing enough to merit further investigation. I think certainly when he talks about the London artist Claire Dewdney, which is described as a hyper-fantastic artist, that's fantastic PH, as an artist who's able to, as she puts it, imagine the self as a network of relationships in flux, which is fragmented, uncertain, and complex, and is able really to see and experience and visualize very powerfully imaginative scenes. That certainly seemed to me to be plausible as a way of connecting with Blake, and I visited Claire Dewdney's website and been investigating her work further. And I think that John Higgs is onto something with that, certainly.
I suppose, whether or not all of those cultural references come off, they are international in range, or pretty international in range, aren't they? And as Lucy said in her introduction, William Blake versus the world isn't exactly a modest title in its reach. So it's the world part that I'm wondering about here. How international is Blake now? Is he still very much a kind of a British or even English phenomenon, or does he have a rich life beyond these shores?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think that John Higgs is going some way towards addressing that by using these contemporary theories of the mind and showing that this is a Blake very much for the 2020s and for the 2030s. So by bringing him very much into the modern world, which of course is a far more cosmopolitan world than Blake himself lived in, is one way of thinking about global Blake. But this isn't, in fact, the first book that John Higgs has written about Blake. A couple of years ago, he published a very short, very readable book called William Blake Now, Why He Matters More Than Ever. And in that, he has a chapter on a Blake video game, on a computer game. And so in that sense, you know, Blake has gone into a version of popular culture, which is properly global. I think this game was marketed in Japan.
What do you do in the game? I now immediately want to play it.
I'm afraid I don't play computer games, so I just read them.
I'm going to go and look this up.
You have to find out and report back, Lucy.
I wonder if you kind of fire the angels out of the tree. No, that would be
that
too,
wouldn't be in keeping with Blake's feeling.
No, that wouldn't be good. You could blast people's mind forged manacles off, yes, and then everyone would be free.
I don't think that the depth of Blake analysis in the game would probably, you know, merit much investigation. But I think that it's the fact that Blake is a springboard and offers this sort of fantastic range of materials of resources that are connected in multifarious ways through his, I mean, for want of a better term, divinities such as Ures and Los and so forth, that they are these sort of colossal entities that engage in these sort of cosmic struggles, which are both at the, you know, gigantic mythological level, and it also have a personal relevance, and they're focused on London and on England and on the human body and so forth. So they offer layers and layers and layers of possibility, whether it's for other writers and artists to delve, or indeed for games designers to plunder.
So I wonder, finally, I'm afraid, because we could talk about Blake for a long time, couldn't we? But you say at the end of your piece, are we catching up with Blake, or have we not caught up with him yet? What do you think?
Well, I think that John Higgs's book has made a step in the right direction. And it's a very useful reminder of Blake within this alternative English tradition. I mean, John Higgs sort of frequently references artists such as Alan Moore. Indeed, Alan Moore turns up in this, you know, the graphic novelist and indeed novelist and artist Alan Moore. He references the Illuminatus trilogy, as well as the Diggers and the Levellers of the 17th century. So there's that sort of sense of this radical tradition. It has been recognised since perhaps at least the time of Christopher Hill, but we need to keep being reminded of it, and it needs to be demonstrated that it is a very topical and relevant aspect of our identity, and particularly a way in which we can mobilise culture to actually give us, to provide us what we need. And that really is where John Higgs is heading at the end of this book. He really wants to empower the imagination. He wants to use Blake as a template for a much more adventurous way of reimagining and re-enchanting the world. And he's not alone in that. There are other writers and artists who have been moving towards this. But, you know, what really this is about is explaining the role and the value of literature and art at this particular juncture, at a time of climate change, environmental collapse, not to mention Brexit and the pandemic. What can art offer us? And it can offer us an alternative, and we can actually participate in that as not only thinking and feeling, but imaginative beings ourselves.
That's a wonderful challenge for us to rise to. After this, we all have to go out and re-enchant the world.
it's certainly ambitious.
Yeah, something to aim for. I mean, really.
But I think that we do need to be reminded of the value of the arts.
Yes.
I suppose that's the thing, that the subtitle of John Higgs's previous book is Why William Blake Matters Now More Than Ever. But I suppose we can rewrite that subtitle very easily to Why the Arts Matter Now More Than Ever, when they're so challenged by cuts and...
Absolutely. But Blake, you know, would have found the challenges that face us in the 21st century. He would have been incandescent with rage, but that would have inspired him, and he would be producing literature and visual art to try to show what roots there might be, how we can think and imagine our ways out, how we can imagine a future, really, which is brighter than the apocalyptic prognostications that we face, you know, on an almost daily basis.
We were going to end on a high note, but now we're going to end on apocalyptic. We nearly got there. No, but thank you very much.
Blake is apocalyptic.
He is, isn't he? Apocalyptic, but also uplifting.
Think about the fires as being purified.
Here's to William Blake then.
Okay, Nick Grew, many thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, a few items of note from this week's TLS and the improbably enthralling fiction of Mario Livrero. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. You may even have spotted the odd bonus episode. We've added selected long reads from the paper for you to enjoy. And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer. Exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5 or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we wade into that thicket of mundane incidentals, Lucy, I believe you have a piece you want to tell us about.
Yeah, a few pieces, actually. Kind of eclectic selection of subjects. There was a piece, the Stanfirst calls it a jocular but damning account of the decline of local newspapers. And it's a funny mix of someone who's worked in it. The book is by a guy called Roger Littolis. And he's been working in local newspapers for many years. And it's a funny account of, as it says, you know, the demise of a whole industry or something that used to be at the heart of a community.
Is this the brilliantly titled Panic as Man Burns Crumpets?
Yes. And it's got also, I just have to say, the picture that goes with it has got these brilliant, you know, the boards that have got the headlines on.
Yeah.
One of them is in the Argus. The headline is UKIP candidate hit by bog roll. The other one on the Ham and High, which is a London paper, isn't it? Is Francis Bacon's ghost lurking in pub?
Yes,
brilliant.
I mean, probably.
It must be. But it's not. I mean, and that stuff is brilliant and funny. But it's not just that stuff, of course. The guy who wrote it said he enjoyed sort of being the underdog and sticking up for the underdog and looking for the little stories that might, you know, reveal, you know, bigger sort of truths or problems.
Because
so that was
overall
really
interesting. It's not a happy story overall, is it? It's
not
demise,
at all,
as you said, but
yeah, it really is. Yeah,
these kind of the vacuum that has been created,
I suppose. Yes, and I think the demise is because of a number of things. The internet,
I've heard of it.
Yeah, well, it's not friendly to local journalism. And social media has, as you say, has come in to fill the vacuum, and it's perhaps not always as reliable as it might be, shall we say.
Hmm.
And the other thing that I found interesting was about bold philosophy.
Oh, yes, I haven't read this at all. You're going to have to explain.
You don't have to be bold to do it, it turns out, so that's good. The book is by Simon Critchley, and it's a selection of lots of bite-sized small essays, which were originally published in the New York Times. And his idea is, I think the premise is that it's not academic writing. It's philosophy, which is without the standard academic protective headgear.
Oh, so the writing itself, the writing itself is bald. Oh, yeah. I was imagining, I mean, Michel Foucault, basically.
Well, I mean, maybe he's probably in there, isn't he? So it's without an elaborate scholastic toupee.
I see.
Just in case you were reaching for your elaborate scholastic toupee, this is writing without one. So Simon Critchley apparently went bald at 40 and accepted this. And he also strived to go bald with his writing, exposing his thinking in uncovered ways. So he talks about philosophical questions in small, I guess, bald, bite-sized essays.
Right, and he is known for a clear style, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And it's it sounds really interesting. And it talks about, you know, the big questions: what do you believe? What makes you happy? What are philosophers for? Apparently, philosophy kills. He wants to have the same kind of message that you have on cigarette packets. He thinks should come with philosophy. You shouldn't do it on your own. We all have to do it together. But we're all, and the big take home, which is not a new one, I don't think, which doesn't present it as such, it's not giving us the answers, just asking the right questions.
Well, I have a piece that I want to flag as well then.
Go ahead.
Just so as not to be left out. Well, I had wanted to have Marina Warner on the podcast this week to talk through the book herself, because she's read it and reviewed it brilliantly. So, but she couldn't make it, so I'll give it my best. But the book is called The Invention of Sicily, A Mediterranean History by Jamie McKay. And it starts, well, Marina Warner starts out from, she points out how Sicily, you know, is the largest island in the Mediterranean, and it used to occupy a central position on the maps. She points to this 17th century vellum portolan, and she says how the rhomb lines crisscross between Asia and Africa, the Atlantic and Europe, and converge on the island's many ports. And these are ports which, incidentally, have never been closed, you know, not even during the Crusades. And no matter how hard one recent Italian politician of the far right, who I shan't name, tried. But this position has made Sicily a site of struggle, she says, from ancient times to the Second World War, when it was battered by the advancing Allies. So as Marina explains, this idea of Sicily as a centre, the kind of hub, has long been supplanted by the idea of it as a marginal, dusty, crumbling, you know, doomed romance, even. You think
sort of deep south type thing.
Yeah. You think of Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa's portrayal of the island, the futility of change on the island.
It's all fading. And yeah.
Exactly. It's all faded glory. And Marina Warner has this wonderful phrase of the chapels and churches as Miss Havisham's. So these stories are, you know, a major part of the island's image now. Those ones, and stories about the mafia in fact and fiction, and you know, those are true stories. But I suppose it seems like the project of Jamie McKay is to reinvent Sicily. So not to deny those pasts and those particular strands of the story, but to challenge their dominance, I suppose. So he kind of tries to recast the negatives and see things in a different light. And he points to the rich history of, you know, there's a bunch of examples of enlightened governance and living in Sicily. One of them is how a century before the Magna Carta, Roger II proclaimed, which doesn't sound very regal, does it, somehow, Roger II? But anyway, he proclaimed religious tolerance for all faiths.
That's just, oh yeah, when I saw that, that's completely extraordinary.
Astounding, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good old Roger II. And in 1231, the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, dubbed Stupor Mundi by his friends and the Antichrist of Palermo by his enemies, issued the Constitutions of Melfi. And these were laws that included, apparently, quite far-sighted ecological measures, as well as the right to divorce. So again, pretty enlightened for the 1200s. It just sounds really good.
Let me ask you one thing about Sicily.
Yes.
So because when I spent any time there, I had quite bad Italian, but I could understand, you know, a bit of what was said to me, let's say further north. Uh-huh. But by the time I got to Sicily, I couldn't really. Is that normal?
Well, yeah, I mean, if they were speaking to you in dialect, then certainly, and I'd be.
I think maybe they
lost.
Were, but I think maybe they were doing it on purpose. And I don't blame them at all.
Yes, I'm from near Milan, and I think I would, if they spoke to me in dialect, I'd be completely at sea.
That's what I was wondering.
Which is fitting, because it's an island.
Yeah, of course. So the point is, but does everyone speak the dialect? But is it just that they can go into Italian, as it were, in inverted commas, when they want to?
The history of bilingualism in Italy is really, really interesting and far too long to go into on this podcast now. If you think about it, going down the peninsula, there are something like 32 or 33 different languages, and they're regional, you know, they're proper languages. I said dialetto, dialect, but they are actually minority languages. In the south, I think it's over towards, over in Calabria, they speak Greco, which is basically ancient Greek.
Really? But still?
Yeah, not so much. Older people probably still will. And there's probably a revival going on. There always seems to be. But older people will tend to speak their dialect and standard Italian, because standard Italian is very, very new. It was only really made the national language in the 1860s. And most people still didn't speak it. I mean, when the Italian army was wandering around in the First World War, troops from Torino apparently met troops from somewhere in the south, and they thought each other was the enemy. it's an apocryphal story, probably. But, you know, it gives you a sense of things. If you think, so my grandma speaks three languages. Well, actually, she speaks four, because she also speaks some English. But she speaks Italian, Veneto and Friulano. And Friulano is a mad language. See, so sorry, this was quite a digression.
I just thought about
it. Back to the TLS, though.
Yes.
There's two other things I just want to point out before we move on to our final segment. One is, there is a fiery exchange on the letters page this week between Kate Hext and Alan Hollinghurst. He was rather critical of Hext's recent commentary piece on the flirtatious letters between Carl Van Vechten and Ronald Furbank. And it is quite heated.
Yes, it is.
I look forward to more. It's very, very interesting, very spirited.
There's no holds barred, I
No,
would say.
Exactly. Definitely not. And there's also a new poem by John Mull called Texts, which begins, Dostoevsky's laundry list, Herman Melville's kippers, the last card Forster played at whist, Auden's bedroom slippers. How could you not want to read on, Lucy?
I do want to read on. I have read on. Others may as well.
Exactly. So anyway, now though, let's turn to Mario Livrero, the Uruguayan master of the miraculous mundane, but a master who probably not many of us have heard of. A final work, the luminous novel, translated into English by Annie McDermott, has not long been published. It's Museum of Unfinished Stories, all provisional, never definitive, capping off a lifetime spent trying to write his way out of the clutter of existence. Sound cheery? Well, Michael Kerrigan is here to tell us more. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
The book under review, the luminous novel, is, on the surface at least, a pretty tough sell, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, Annie McDermott, as you said, translated, described it as empty to the brim. And while that's a very neat summary, it's actually perfect, but it just gives an impression of, empty paradox, and there is much more to it than that. It's extremely engaging read. It's great fun, although it's true that nothing much really happens, and he never really gets to the novel he's supposed to be writing.
The bulk of the novel is a prologue, you describe. So there's this long prologue, and the whole thing is, you describe it as carefully curated tedium. So what are its kind of constituent items? You know, what details do we see? Just give us a sense of what it's like to read it.
Well, it's very much the banalities of every day. He wrestles with a new air conditioning system, and he goes to the supermarket and quarrels with the lady on the checkout, and he buys more trashy detective novels, which he devours, and he watches a dead pigeon decomposing on a flat roof underneath his bedroom window, and puzzles about it, and how it died, and what happened, and what's going to happen next, and so forth. It reminds me a little bit of Tristram Shandy, where he says, 6 months in, and the 200 pages in, I still haven't been born, and actually, I don't think he knew he was born, because Livrero goes much further, and by saying much less.
And is it funny, because the way you're describing it, it sounds actually very boring, which I think you think it isn't, but it's actually very funny. He doesn't mind poking fun at himself, does he, and saying, I spent a long time watching a decomposing pigeon?
Not at all. I mean, it is funny. It's self-deprecating humor. In English terms, it's a little bit pooter. It's a little bit H.G. Wells's History of Mr. Polly. I mean, think of these kind of, you know, anti-heroes of everyday, you know, quietness and so forth. So it's not unprecedented that there should be humor in that. But at the same time, there's this sort of almost gravity-defying sense of him fashioning such a huge novel out of this, and there's a sense that he has, and we have, and in fact Annie McDermott in an afterword says, you know, she had this sense of hurrying and scurrying and trying to get somewhere and not getting somewhere, and it's a bit like trying to climb out of a sandpit, and you know, it is in that sense absurd. So, you know, we are kind of implicated in that.
There's a passive quality you describe to the work, an illusion of passivity, I suppose. You say it's the reader who does the work here.
Yeah, I think he's trying to write without writing, and I think he tapped into a thought that, you know, again, many writers have had before, that when the writing has achieves liftoff, it sort of leaves the writer behind in some way. And, you know, you can go back to Dr. Johnson saying, you know, go through what you've written. If you find a passage that seems particularly pleasing to you, strike it out, because the, you know, in the end, whilst on the one hand the writer wants the writing to sing and the text to achieve liftoff, you know, I think in his own way, Levrero's engaged trying to nail that same thing, you know.
And it was published posthumously, this book, so I'm wondering where does it sit in the context of his work? Well, actually, perhaps before you answer that question, perhaps you could just run us through what did come before the Luminous novel. You know, how did Levrero make his name? You mentioned an involuntary trilogy, which is an excellent term.
And I think quite a revealing one, again, because it's sort of disowning any sense of authorial will, which is obviously in one sense disingenuous, but in another sense it's obviously true for him. For someone who only died in 2004, a surprising amount doesn't really seem to be known about him. He was quite secretive. He didn't really give many interviews. He was known for writing short squibs and, you know, bits of sci-fi stories, that kind of thing. Yeah. There's a gap of sort of wry comedies and so forth in the late 80s. I should perhaps say that of course, 1973 to 1985, Uruguay was under military dictatorship, and that was quite a good time for a writer to be quite guarded. He did go and live in Argentina for a few years. No one really knows why during that period. And in the 90s, he starts doing this thing with the empty words, the empty discourse novel, where he's trying to access himself via his handwriting. And that's a sort of strange sort of, like a kind of surrealistic experiment of automatic writing, but he's trying to explore his inner self by just seeing how he handwrites.
Oh, but by sort of really looking at the shape that his letters take on the page and that sort of thing, using that as a right, wow.
Literally, and of course it doesn't really yield reports that you and I would recognise as revelation, but you know, we see it as it's a way of excluding context and of rather than having the Kafkaesque, you know, sort of mysterious, absurd context that the books of the first trilogy had, and that didn't quite get him where he wanted to go. He's trying to do it now by you know, exploring himself from the outside in. You know, how do I know what I am till I see not just what I write, but how I write? And of course, the problem is that what I write is potentially misleading. Back to the thing of, you know, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. Once you sort of, you know, once a novelist creates a world, that world produces, you know, it becomes a center of gravity within the work, if you like. And, you know, that's not what he wants.
He sounds like someone from, I mean, I was almost going to say, it's silly to say Borges, because I don't mean just because he's South American, he sounds a bit like that. But when you say short fiction and, you know, he's trying to change himself via his handwriting and starts off doing, do you know, and he's a secretive figure, He sounds like it, almost like a self-conscious construct from a novel.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's not easy to find a lot of material he wrote, and I was intrigued by the interest. You know, for obvious reasons, Borges would be an obvious person to have influenced him. He certainly takes, you know, Latin American literature back to that sort of minimalism and so forth. After most of us in the outside world, we think of Latin America, and we think of Garcia Marquez, and we think of these exotic, essentially kind of rainforest environments with beautiful scarlet flowers and parakeets and incredible butterflies and so forth. And I think, well, first of all, for kind of understandable reasons, I think Latin American novelists, you know, eventually kind of started to kick against that anyway. But also I think their priorities were different. And I think that they saw Virginia Woolf as a kind of no question A-list, you know, world writer, and which I do too, but I don't think her status is so secure in the English speaking world. But I think this thing of trying to kind of, you know, the traffic jam with the kind of red buses, and it's all like beads in a string, or you know, that kind of thing. It's this incredible sense of a visual world and so forth. You know, that stopped being what it was about, if you like. And I think it was, you know, a retreat within. And again, that's why once I talk in my review about, you know, the relationship with Saint Teresa.
Well, what is that relationship with Saint Teresa then? Because she sort of is a kind of talisman for him.
That's right. I mean, yeah, okay. The relationship is with Saint Teresa is pivotal in my review. It's not pivotal in his novel, but it is significant. And I think it is really the reasons why. I mean, I think that, you know, she's a terribly charismatic figure for us now. And the thing about her is that to me that reminds me of Livrero is that she was constantly trying to push against the grain of writing, and she, you know, she didn't want to be seen as going out into the world and so forth the way George Eliot saw her. She wanted to ascend within herself. And I'm not particularly saying that Livrero is, I don't think he's particularly a religious writer, but I think he's latched onto that sense that you know, that all the kind of residue that sort of adheres to language and story and imagery and all the things that make fiction generally, a lot of the things that we go to fiction for most of the time, in fairness, but all those things are things that are sort of cluttering, you know, his path to find this whatever it is that isn't essence, but kind of sounds rather like it.
Yeah, and it's true as well that, I mean, one of the other you know, if there's anything more, anything beyond that similarity in terms of how Saint Teresa found it hard to create and to write in the same way as Livrero does, there's also in terms of the religious aspect of it, there's also that thing that you get quite often. I'm thinking about Gonzalo Tavares, the Portuguese writer. He's been keeping a plague diary,
right,
for the past 18 months, or however long it's been, a decade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
and there is something that happens, I think. It sounds sort of similar to Livrero in that it's if you're almost listing these, you know, small observations of day-to-day life, and you read them, and after a while, there does seem to be some almost kind of hymnic quality to them. They have a cumulative effect on you. They speak to each other and develop a kind of a mood that is somehow sort of akin to a religious experience. If that's not, I don't mean to make that sound grand, but it's just that idea of an overall effect that can come out of that kind of writing.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anyone reads a 500 plus page novel for self-deprecating humor. I mean, it's quasi-religious in its ambition and scale, I think, for sure.
There's another comparison you make, not quite a saint, but a hero, shall we say, of autofiction, of Karl Ove Knausgård. It's a sort of comparison you make with him, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, perhaps a bit prejudiced. I kind of, to me, he doesn't come out quite so well from a comparison, but that's probably a matter of, you know, of taste. I feel he's his is a more self-consciously heroic struggle, and I find Levrero, his self-deprecation is not just a sort of philosophical mystic thing. It is also, it's engaging. We most of us like self-deprecating people more than we like people who big themselves up, and you know, that's not advanced literary criticism.
it's just true. So would you say, just on a final note, would you say that Levrero is an important figure then? I mean, there's been something of a lag between the original publications and their Anglophone version. So I'm wondering, you know, do you think with the help now of his translator, Annie McDermott, who you say has done a wonderful job here, is he starting to be appreciated as important outside of Latin American letters?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, Annie McDermott has not just done a bang up job here. She's been a champion for him over a number of years now, and that's making a mark on her culture just by doing that. You know, if she didn't do anything else, but I think that I think we've been waiting to read something like this. Yeah.
Well, Michael Kerrigan, thank you very much for introducing him to me. As I say, I had not heard of him, and I'm grateful. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Michael Kerrigan and Nick Groom. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.